Welcome to the Wellbeing Ignites Well-Doing podcast, produced by OOT Social Health, where the focus is on exploring the essential elements that drive organizational success, human-centric leadership. Hosted by Adjoa Boahidi, principal of AKB Talent Edge.
Looking forward to my discussion today with Mike Tweedy. We're going to talk about what leaders need to think in the age of and do in the age of AI. In particular, how to lead in a changing workplace. And given that our mission is to highlight the importance of remaining human-centric, we want to explore what leaders need to know and do to ignite well-doing through well-being in the age of AI. This conversation is particularly timely as I woke up this morning and heard that Geoffrey Hinton, known as the grandfather of AI, a U of T professor, was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics. Let me start by introducing our guest today. Mike Tweedy is currently the head of enterprise architecture and IT strategy at OnExpress Transportation Partners. He has held a series of senior roles in IT that focus on leveraging and optimizing technology in global enterprises. He's particularly adept at being able to drive strategy and productivity through transformation and innovation, focusing on the success of the business. He has a couple decades of experience, so I know our conversation is rooted in Mike's experience of helping organizations, leaders, and team members embrace the evolution of tech and the internet. Perhaps more importantly, after our prep call or during our prep call, I came to know that Mike is a vinyl head who proudly showed me one of his prized possessions, the original press of Billie Holiday's first album. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you. This is going to be very exciting, and I have to say I really appreciate that. I like to say that I've earned all of this.
That's it, Mike. Well, I am going to highlight that again in a few moments as I pose my first questions. Your wealth of experience, and certainly I wouldn't say that you're the grandfather of IT because you're too young for that. So before we get into the depth of our conversation, Mike, and really delve deeper, I want to ask you a couple of questions that are based on the Proust questionnaire. So Marcel Proust was an essayist and writer who wanted to talk to people about or try to get the essence of who somebody was. And he felt these questions really did the trick in finding out who somebody is. We, at the Wellbeing Council, we focus on being human-centric or the importance of remaining human-centric in our new age. And so you're human. And so I'm going to center on you. The first question I'd like to ask you is, which talent would you most like to have, Mike?
This is an interesting question, and I've thought quite a bit about it. And I think, interestingly, the first thing is I want to fly. I want to be, I want to be Superman. I don't think so. I think one of the things that I think is really important has nothing to do with work directly is I want to be a person that can bring kindness back to the world. How can we take what is a very divisive world and all the shenanigans and things that are happening across this planet and just make people stop and think about people and how to do what we need to do to make life a little bit better for everybody. So that sounds a little cliche, but I just think that would be a really cool thing to be able to do. How do we make people just stop and think, hey, you know what? There's a person at the other end of this. Maybe we need to think about this differently. And I think I would also like to fly. Don't get me wrong, but I do think we have more important things to solve right now.
That's amazing. That's a lovely answer. And should you ever be up for the Mr. Universe contest, I would suggest also using that one. If you were to die and were to come back as a person or thing, what would it be?
Only because I can see it out of the corner of my eye, I'd like to be my dog, who is right now upside down and asleep on my bed. So his very best life. And I think that would be not a bad thing. Zero stress.
Exactly.
Except maybe if I was slightly late with meals. But yeah, I would like to. I think who wouldn't want to experience something else like that?
Nice. Well, and with a good owner like you, I'm sure you are, that would be a golden life. So let's get into it, Mike. You, as I mentioned, you've been in it quite a while. So give us a perspective on the evolution in the workplace. We don't have to go back as far back as when computers were invented. But I do remember a time, for example, when the use of the internet was frowned upon in the workplace. So can you talk a little bit about the evolution of tech that you've seen and experienced in the workplace?
Yeah, I do want to go back a little bit in history because this is interesting. It's funny, I've been giving this one some thought too. If you were a Ford employee in 1913 walking into the Highland Park facility and Henry Ford was showing you the assembly line, you'd have lost your mind. Here was such a massive change in manufacturing and how we manufacture and the ability to manufacture at speed efficiently and accurately. You weren't thinking about that. You were thinking about what's going on with my job? What am I going to do? Interestingly enough, he handled that a slightly different way, which is he paid everybody a lot of money. He gave everybody a good, solid living wage and you know, he won the hearts and minds. But that kind of disruption is not new. We've had some funny pop culture references. Loved Mad Men. And there was an episode of Mad Men where all the ad guys are sitting around and they're rolling in an IBM computer. And you'd have thought it was the end of the world. And yes. And it, you know, we're talking, what is that, 1960, 62, somewhere in there. So these disruptions are not new. And, you know, whether it was the internet, whether it was the ability to have a computer in your hand, whether it was the ability to see every single thing that's ever been created and be able to consume it in a way that we've never been able to, these disruptions are not new. And interestingly enough, maybe scary at the time, but life-changing as we consume them. So I think what's happening now is very similar. And I'm going to, you know, you're going to ask me the question about what to fear. I don't think there's anything to fear yet. And, you know, it's how we choose to embrace and consume and leverage the tools that we're being given, because these are just tools.
Fair. I think we might have a little debate as we go on through this, because even Geoffrey Hinton, you know, had some cautionary notes, right? Yeah. As it relates to what I like to call the HAL concept, for those of us who remember the movie 2001, right? No, Dave, you're not getting off the spaceship. So the doors are closed. And the other piece of the Mad Men that I love is I saw the one where they were out on a picnic and they were drinking and eating. And when they went to leave, they just pulled up the blanket and left all the debris, all the trash in the park. And I remember being visually shocked by that. But we've come a long way on that too. Pick up after yourself. AI has been part of our world for quite a while. I think that some people don't recognize or even know. Longer than before ChatGPT, there are versions of AI that were already being used in the workplace. Applicant tracking systems, for example, used to collect, sort, and determine potential interview candidates in recruitment use AI. Now we're entering into the era of generative AI. And I've done some reading, but it might be helpful for our listeners who are not as tech savvy as you or others to explain what that means. What is the difference between AI and generative AI?
I think we need to step back a little bit in history too. So AI is not new. The ability to have, you know, a machine execute a task on our behalf is not new. And the ability to have machines execute a series of tasks on our behalf is not new. But that's not necessarily the ability to think about it or make decisions. It's tab A, slot B type sequence. So let's stick with Ford, for example. Right now, grab parts, weld parts, move the item further down the line for the next robot to grab parts, weld parts. That's not new. What's interesting and what's becoming really, really cool about that is certain manufacturers, and I'll stick on manufacturing just because it's top of mind, the ability to know that, hey, I've consumed a bunch of parts, I need to go make some more, or I need to bring another bin of parts in because this robot's going to run out of things. There was a flaw with this one. It doesn't meet all the required tolerance and I need to change it out. Generative AI is a little bit different. And so if we go back to, say, a ChatGPT-3, where you feed it a question or some prompts, and it's grabbing what it thinks the answer is, and will produce an image, will produce content. And I think there's a third part to the answer that I'll get to. But the real difference between a traditional AI and what generative AI is, traditional AI didn't create the thing, it executed a task. Generative AI is creating new things, whether we like it or not, based on what it sees and knows and learns, based on what information you're feeding it. In a ChatGPT concept, it's a large language model where it's feeding that language model from wherever, and you can control and allow it to see certain pockets of information, and it will make decisions, make the best possible decision based on that information. What I think is really interesting now, especially with a ChatGPT-4, and we're going to see it with Apple AI, certainly with what Google's doing with their new release, is the ability to make much more educated decisions when it's creating a thing. And I think a few things come out of that. One is it's going, you know, it has the ability to stop and go, maybe this isn't the right thing, or maybe this isn't real information, or maybe this. So the ability for AI to stop and think and make better decisions based on the information it's being fed is new. And that's new in the last little while and wildly different. If you have the opportunity to mess around with some of these new tools, you'll see it happen. But the real difference between traditional AI and generative AI is the ability to create something from nothing. And that when we do get to talk about the fears, that's when the fears start to come in. But it's a really interesting thing, and how that impacts how we work, how we produce our work, very, very different, and something we have to get in front of now.
That's such an excellent explanation, super clear, for even somewhat, I call myself sometimes a semi-Luddite. So that was fantastic.
Nice.
Comment on what I'm going to say, Mike, because I have used ChatGPT and Claude and Gemini and so on. And so far, and maybe this is a matter of evolution, so far I have found it interesting at times, but I've also found it inaccurate. And so it from my perspective, if I was a leader, and certainly, and you know, we could do a whole podcast on leaders managing performance as team members start using AI as a work product, is that it's important, I think, still to have the skill as the human to evaluate and review what ChatGPT is producing. Because not only, I had somebody produce a profile of me and then post it without my permission on LinkedIn, and it was grossly inaccurate. So I had to email them and say, take that down, because, I mean, it could have damaged in some ways my reputation as well because of the inaccuracies, assuming that people would think that I had authorized this. And then also when I've used it in my work, I really look at, you know, the product that's being produced by ChatGPT and others, all of them, and I review it and I change it and I rewrite it because it's not always accurate. Can you comment on that, please?
Yeah, so it's, again, most of the, you know, these tools don't have the ability to think. They're not us yet. Ask Jeffrey Hinton. And so it's making decisions and producing information based on the information it was fed. So if you're dealing with a free version of a tool, that I don't want to stick on OpenAI, but you're getting a very limited amount of information. And if that information is even slightly wrong, then the product is going to be not exactly perfect. So it all depends on the information that it's being fed. It's not thinking, hey, you know, this is not what I think Edgewood looks like. So, but you know, and this doesn't really, it's not thinking like you and I would, it's not using common sense in many cases. So I think that's one of the hurdles that we're trying to get over now. And something I think you'll see happen very, very quickly. We already see it with the new versions of the tools, the ability to stop and go, wait a second, that doesn't jive. And the ability to then go and make better decisions based on finding more information, I think is a good thing. But you're right. It's not, you know, it's not using a lot of critical thinking, because that's not what it is. But I think that's only a matter of time. So we have to sort of understand that sooner than later and get in front of that. It also depends 100% on. In fact, I think I got an ad for some online university that was a course just on feeding prompts to a generative AI tool. So what you ask it will 100% determine the output you get. So you can ask much better questions. We can get into a long discussion about about bias. So if I ask a question one way, I'll get a certain bias. And if I ask it a different way, I'll get a very different view. And it's so that how you prompt the tool becomes really important, and the ability to refine that prompt as you go is absolutely 100% on you. So you start off on the wrong foot, your content's going to be inaccurate. It's going to be, it's not going to be awesome. So how you choose to prompt it becomes really, really important.
Fair. I think we might have a little debate as we go on through this, because even Jeffrey Hinton, you know, had some cautionary notes, right? Yeah. As it relates to what I like to call the HAL concept, for those of us who remember the movie 2001, right? No, Dave, you're not getting off the off the spaceship. Pick up after yourself. AI has been part of our world for quite a while. I think that some people don't recognize or even know. Longer than before ChatGPT, there are versions of AI that were already being used in the workplace. Applicant tracking systems, for example, used to collect, sort, and determine potential interview candidates in recruitment use AI. Now we're entering into the era of generative AI. And I've done some reading, but it might be helpful for our listeners who are not as tech savvy as you or others to explain what that means. What is the difference between AI and generative AI?
I think we need to step back a little bit in history too. So AI is not new. The ability to have, you know, a machine execute a task on our behalf is not new. And the ability to have machines execute a series of tasks on our behalf is not new. But that's not necessarily the ability to think about it or make decisions. It's tab A slot B type sequence. So let's stick with Ford, for example. Right now, grab parts, weld parts, move the item further down the line for the next robot to grab parts, weld parts. That's not new. What's interesting and what's becoming really, really cool about that is certain manufacturers, and I'll stick on manufacturing just because it's top of mind, the ability to know that, hey, I've consumed a bunch of parts, I need to go make some more, or I need to bring another bin of parts in because this robot's going to run out of things. There was a flaw with this one. It doesn't meet all the required tolerance, and I need to change it out. Generative AI is a little bit different. And so if we go back to, say, a ChatGPT-3, where you feed it a question or some prompts, it's grabbing what it thinks the answer is and will produce an image, will produce content. And I think there's a third part to the answer that I'll get to. But the real difference between a traditional AI and what generative AI is, traditional AI didn't create the thing, it executed a task. Generative AI is creating new things, whether we like it or not, based on what it sees and knows and learns, based on what information you're feeding it. In a ChatGPT concept, it's a large language model where it's feeding that language model from wherever, and you can control and allow it to see certain pockets of information, and it will make decisions, make the best possible decision based on that information. What I think is really interesting now, especially with a ChatGPT-4, and we're going to see it with Apple AI, certainly with what Google's doing with their new release, is the ability to make much more educated decisions when it's creating a thing. And I think a few things come out of that. One is it's going, you know, it has the ability to stop and go, maybe this isn't the right thing, or maybe this isn't real information, or maybe this. So the ability for AI to stop and think and make better decisions based on the information it's being fed is new. And that's new in the last little while and wildly different. If you have the opportunity to mess around with some of these new tools, you'll see it happen. But the real difference between traditional AI and generative AI is the ability to create something from nothing. And that, when we do get to talk about the fears, that's when the fears start to come in. But it's a really interesting thing, and how that impacts how we work, how we produce our work, very, very different, and something we have to get in front of.
Which leads us nicely into our next question, or my next question to you, is what opportunities does the integration of AI in the workplace present?
I think it's here. It's always been here. And it's been here certainly as long as I've been working. So I don't think it's new, but I do think if we look at what we're looking at in terms of artificial intelligence and the ability to do work today, I think the integration becomes a little bit secondary. And I'll answer that as a second part to the question. I think the first thing is what does AI present in the ability to employ people? How does that change the nature of work? And I think that's the first thing we have to understand. You know, those repetitive tasks, we've already handled. There's machines that do the thing for you. The robot at Ford, you know, welding on a plate. Those things already exist. It's those cognitive tasks that, you know, we want to start to let the machines do. So what's happened, I think, you know, it all depends on, you know, I'll give you an example. Apple Vision Pro. So their spatial computing platform, they don't like to use VR or AR. They want to call it something very Apple-y. But what a brilliant platform. So they are, you know, they've worked with vendors like Porsche and KLM to the ability to have people trained to work on a massive Boeing engine completely virtually. So you no longer do you need to have a giant hangar with a dollar engine in there for people to learn how to change, you know, parts and pieces on those things. They can do most of that training now completely virtually, working on the digital twin of a completely accurate Boeing engine. So that kind of integration, I think, is going to be absolutely for us. And I think we're starting to see that. The ability to learn faster, the ability to understand how to do things quicker and to do it more accurately is a really big thing. The other thing is and I think this is a really great thing, is one, it allows you to connect to a workforce that's literally global now. No longer is language a problem. Accessibility becomes much easier to handle. So the ability to work in a different way, in a truly global manner, and you can find skills anywhere in the world to connect people in a way that we haven't been able to before, legitimately collaborate on things. That, I think, is a really big thing. But the other thing, I think, like I said at the beginning, it's going to change how we work. So we need to you know, that prompt engineer is a great example. So this becomes a hammer and a screwdriver. We just have to learn how to swing and turn it. And I think that's the difference. As employers, we need to understand that work is going to be different. We're not going to be doing the things we've done in the past. And how are we tooling our business to align and exploit that? But in the same token, how are we training and educating our new employees to do the work we need them to do? So there's two things that really have to happen in terms of the integration of AI. I don't think AI is going to steal jobs, certainly not in my lifetime. I think we are going to become far more productive in our ability to do things because of AI. But that changes how we work, and that changes the nature of our education, and it changes the way people are employed. So I think that we could talk for about 4 hours just on these things. But I think there's a bigger, broader view here, which is, don't think it's going to steal our jobs, but we need to change how we approach employment and how we educate people to do these jobs. So that ability to bring the common sense to the machine becomes really important.
I think for leaders, in particular leaders of a certain age, of which I will put myself in, certainly not necessarily you, Mike, is being able to switch our thinking as leaders as well. Because to your point, as the younger entrants come into the workplace, they will actually already bring up probably a host of skills, because I'm sure universities and colleges are trying to catch up on this new learning or the way in which, to be honest, universities and colleges are also struggling with the use of AI in academia. Right. So that's an issue in and of itself. Having said that, leaders are going to have to think about, how do I restructure also the workday or the work that I'm asking for? To your point, because now I could have a machine or my associate can get that work, what I thought would take them 8 hours to do, because they're using AI, is going to take them an hour. And so now, how do I restructure their, what, you know, they need to produce and their KPIs and so on around this faster speed of no longer needing to, right, turn that screw. A colleague of mine, this great example of her son, who was doing an internship and was given a task, and he layered on, and I'm not going to probably say this correctly, but he layered on AI. He created a spreadsheet that normally would have taken hours to do, was done in 15 minutes. And then he took it to his leader, and his leader was a bit flummoxed, because now what do I do with you? The beauty of it is, we need to rethink about then using those skills and talents of, you know, that young person or anybody brings to the table in a different way to further our business. But I think that's the trick too. It's also for leaders to recognize, maybe those who aren't as comfortable or don't understand it, to really figure out, how do we maximize productivity given that we have this additional tool?
You know, what's interesting, and I'll say this, because this is, whenever these conversations occur, we tend to focus on those office workers, those people sitting at a desk, you know, clicking as if their life depended on it, you know, doing the work at their desk. That's only one portion of the workforce. The nature of the work needs to change without question. And, you know, where that person that was producing a spreadsheet before, maybe that person now needs to be doing things like business intelligence. How do I take AI and take a portion of information and data we're collecting as a company and start to think about how we need to adjust our business in a way that maybe we haven't been able to? How do we address new markets? How do I understand how our products are being consumed? Is there a better way to produce that thing? Again, just the nature of the work needs to change. That person may not spend 8 hours working on a spreadsheet, but now they may be able to take that spreadsheet and go, hey, I've seen, you know, we have better sales in this region when we sell this widget. That level of intelligence has been very hard to do. You know, most enterprises struggle with, they're today still trying to struggle with the data they have. They don't know what to do with it. And, you know, this starts to bridge the ability to do things with that data, because you don't have to think about it. You can let the machine start to go and, you know, show me patterns, show me information, show me things that maybe I didn't understand before. So again, I don't think that work is going away. I think that work needs to change. And how do you exploit that tool to give you vision or direction in a way that you would have taken a very long time to figure out, you know, by yourself? So it's just the nature of the work needs to change. But that, you know, you step outside of the office tower, how do healthcare researchers look at new ways to treat cancer? How does that Ford employee start to figure out how to produce a better car? How do we look at, you know, how to mine for lithium, because we need car batteries, in a way that's not going to destroy our planet? And you know, this is where the tools can become very, very helpful and not scary. So, but again, the nature of the ability and the capabilities of those employees have to change, and the companies that are employing them have to understand that it needs to change with them in a way that'll allow us to just employ people. I think it's a very interesting discussion, and I'll say this much: what a great time to be in technology, because it's super cool to watch
and to be a bystander to watch it, perhaps on the sidelines, and help people think about how do we embrace this. I'm going to come to the notion of fear in a moment, but just to piggyback on your point, as we're talking about office towers and knowledge workers, I heard that radiologists, maybe some doctor of radiology, are now fearful for the roles, in the sense that AI can apparently read screenings much more effectively than the human eye. So when you think about the power of that, being able to detect cancers and breast cancers much, much earlier would be a terrific thing. And so therefore, you know, yes, maybe we'll need less doctors of radiology, or we repurpose them into other functions or other parts of the treatment program. But it's important to recognize, yes, that there's many, many uses of AI in many fields outside of the office tower. So let's talk about fear, Mike. So I have to say there is a piece of me, I don't know if you want to call it devil's advocate or just my cynical nature or being a Gen Xer or all of the above. You know, there is a little bit of fear about the future of what holds. And to me, I equate it to the internet. And the internet is a great, great tool, but we've also seen it do some harm. So should we have any fears, and how do we not lose? And I think about the, you know, employee well-being council on which you and I serve, and how do we ensure that we remain human centric, that we don't lose sight of the human?
I think we need to remember that at least now, and probably for the foreseeable future, these are just machines reacting to information. So the ability to feed that information to the machine to allow it to make decisions is one thing. The fear of the robot uprising, I don't think we're going to see in our lifetime. The Matrix, the HAL 9000s, the ability for the machine to know and understand and make decisions based on a number of things, including emotion, doesn't exist. It's not to say it wouldn't, but there's a lot of work being done around ethical AI and how do you feed the information? How do you control its ability to make decisions? And there's a number of ways to do that, to stick on a to create a Star Trek reference, the prime directives, right? So do no harm, a number of things that you can feed the machine to allow it to do some things. But I think if you walked out in front of Union Station today and started asking people what they fear about AI, they're probably going to be, well, I don't want to lose my job. I don't think they're thinking about the robot uprising. Right. And so I don't think that's necessarily a top of mind thing. However, we do need to understand both the ability for the information and the information it can consume, and therefore decisions can make based on that information, and you know how far we can let it go like that. However, I think if you're looking at immediate terms, immediate fears, it's not so much the machines, it's the exploitation of that, the ability for those things to do that. Deepfake's a great example. So we're staring at a US election. They are genuinely scared about what deepfakes are going to do and create in the weeks prior to the election. And, you know, for the most part, the AI systems aren't elegant enough to make it seem 100% accurate. You know, how many fingers does that picture have is a good example, right?
I'm going to interrupt you. Sorry, Mike, but can you just expand on what a deepfake is? Because again, I don't want to assume that everybody knows what that is, because I think it's super important.
So with the creation of generative AI, especially image producing tools, you can ask it to produce anything and it will. So there's some really nasty stuff out there. Ask Taylor Swift, ask Barack Obama, you know, so there's the ability to make it look and feel and sound as if it was a real person. There's usually some weird artifacts that are enough to make you go, that's not real. However, that's just going to get better and better. So that to me is I'm less worried about AI being the problem and AI being exploited to become a problem, at least in the near term. So, you know, the ability for someone to produce a bunch of misinformation right before a US election that's going to be hard to disprove as people are walking into voter booths is a real scary problem. And one I think that I know the US government is trying to handle. Ethical AI isn't going to fix that. So ability to exploit a tool is, again, not new. Ask the people that produce weapons and how those things get used. It's not new. It's our ability to make better decisions on how to use that tool. So that, to me, if I have any fears, it's the immediate ability for these tools to be exploited in ways that aren't great.
Right. And we have examples of that now. And so it's about creating guardrails around that. To come back to your Star Trek reference, and I'm glad you used Star Trek, not Star Wars. The only thing I know from Star Wars is use your force for good, I think it was, right? And so that would equate to this as well. You know, let's use it for the good and put guardrails around the use of it in a not positive way. Right. And so I think that that is the piece. And I would say for myself and probably others, when we do think beyond losing our jobs, that is the piece that worries people, because we do have examples now of how it's not being used for the good.
And some of the other things, like the ability to use tools to crack passwords, to get access to bank accounts, to there's a number of things that are happening. These are being exploited by, you know, some bad actors, not the machine itself. Will the machine eventually do that? Yeah, maybe. But again, I don't think I'll see that in my lifetime. But, you know, I think the fears are more present and more with respect to the ability for people to exploit the tools. And that, to me, is a bigger worry, and one that is getting more sophisticated every minute of every day. So those are the things that, if that's going to keep me up at night, it's that stuff.
Right. So as you know, at the Employee Wellbeing Council, we want to ensure that inclusion and equity remains a foundational focus. What do we need to do or incorporate into our tech strategies to ensure that we remain inclusive or actually increase inclusivity?
Technology is a really wonderful thing when it comes to the ability to break down barriers, right? So I talked a little bit about this earlier. So you now have the ability to collaborate with anyone, anywhere, regardless of geographic location. You don't care. It doesn't matter. You're looking for capability and skill now. We have the tools to be able to allow that collaboration. I think that's a really big thing. And then on the other side of accessibility. So I now have the ability to things far more accessible. I can consume content in a way that maybe someone who's blind or deaf or whatever, we can produce content in a way that message can be conveyed to people that we maybe haven't been able to before. And you know, so I think that's, to me, technology becomes an enabler. And I think we're just starting to see what that can do. On the AI side, I'm not sure I necessarily understand. I think, you know, if we look at more the consumption of AI and the ability to control bias, I think we're going to see, as these tools evolve a little bit more, I think we're starting to see bias become a little bit less of an issue as the tools stop and say, wait a second, do I think this is accurate? And I think that's going to help. And in fact, might even reduce the amount of bias we would put into it based on just our own ways of doing things. So I think technology becomes a really important enabler there. And I think we're starting to see it. I think it's really important when it comes to being able to connect a global workforce. And I think it's really important to, or at least critical in the ability to remove barriers and make the ability to work far more accessible. And I think that's a really big thing. There's a lot more to it than that, but that's the way I see it.
Yeah. And I think I'm going to bring you back to the point that you said about the bias and the prompt, so that when you're entering something in, it already has potentially a bias inherently within it. So you're going to get out of the machine that which you put in. And so I think that's where we also need to train, we need to educate, we need to help people understand that the very prompt that you're entering may already preclude some of the answers that you're getting out of the machine. So to your point, as perhaps these machines become more intelligent, or as AI becomes more and more sophisticated, it may actually be able to recognize, this is my futuristic hope and desire, that it recognize the inherent bias within that prompt, if there is one, and gives alternates or actually highlights how that prompt actually is already contains certain biases that the answers then reflects. That would be a fantastic future use, where it becomes a check and balance to our very own human fallibility, I think is the word. Frailty sounds a little bit more Jane Eyre-ish. Fallibility in the way in which we work. So we want to talk about practical advice. This has been amazing. I love your descriptions. I love how you've characterized things. I think it's super, speaking of accessible, super accessible. For people to understand, what is the one thing I as a leader am going to do today, Mike, to support my team in understanding or integrating AI into our work, my teamwork?
I think that's a really good question. And it isn't, you know, going out and buying subscriptions to ChatGPT as much as OpenAI would like you to do that. I think it's more to that. I think it's allowing your employees to test and try things that maybe they wouldn't have been able to before and start to see what they can and cannot do with it. I think that's important. You need to create a sandbox for people to go and touch and understand. You know, let's stick on the ability to learn how to give it appropriate levels of prompts and what to do. So there's a certain amount of education that has to happen. You know, if we're sticking with knowledge workers, I think we have to give them the ability to use the tools and understand the tools. I think that's already happening in most cases. In most cases, enterprises are controlling who's consuming what, especially with the ChatGPT. But I do think we haven't done a good job giving that safe space to go and figure it out and come up with innovative ideas. Start to think about, hey, if I had a tool that could do this for me, my job would get this much better, this much more productive, or this much more interesting. And I don't think we do that enough. But I think that, you know, for me today, it's create space. Create space to let people try and encourage and even reward innovation, because I think that's a really big missing part in most enterprises.
I love that idea, Mike. I love that idea. I, as a leader, I could be in marketing, I could be in sales, I could be in operations, I could be in finance, I could be in accounting. Yep. Why not, as a team, I, as a leader, sort of create the sandbox? I like that analogy, right? Of the sandbox, and maybe even give a task or a goal. Let's see how we could use AI to do X. Because then I, as a leader, am feeling perhaps more comfortable as we, as a team, explore the use of it, figure out as a team how we can become more effective and productive before the head of IT comes to us or head of HR comes to us and say, you shall use it in such and such way, and we're going to create a training program and all of these things. There's a way in which to seize the opportunity now and to have fun with it, sounds perhaps in not the right term, but there's a way to use the create that sandbox now and use it as a team learning opportunity as well. Together, we're going to figure out how we can use this to become more productive, more effective.
I agree. I think enterprises today, and it's already too late, but they must today start to think about how to do those things. We've got an entirely new generation of employees going to be coming through and out of university imminently that are very, very different than any generation we've seen. And I don't think we're prepared to employ that kind of person right now. And I think that becomes really important. So how do you start to build that enterprise of the future that's going to employ a very different kind of person who's very, very digitally centric already thinking about better ways to do the things that you're creating that spreadsheet for? So you need to get in front of that. And I think the sooner we do that, the better those enterprises are going to be when those in the next few years with those new knowledge workers hit the street. And I think it's a really good thing.
For sure. And the stronger the leader will be, the more comfortable the leader will be, the higher grade, the higher likelihood of retention, because you're not going to turn off those new employees who are going to say, why are we doing it in such a fuddy-duddy way? There's more effective ways to do it. So you and I could speak for another hour, I'm sure, but we are coming towards the end of our time together. So I do want to wrap up with a couple more Proust questions for you. And one is, if you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be?
I think I'm perfect. So it's probably nothing. No, I think for me, I think I want to be a little bit more patient. I want to be able to, especially dealing with my teams and the work that we're trying to do, give a little bit more space for people to do what they do best. And that requires a little bit of patience and a little bit of trust. And you know, as a dumb IT guy, that's a really hard thing to do as you progress through a career, especially into management or senior management. You don't want to let people do the things you want to do because you're going to do it better. And so being able to bring a little bit more patience, I think that's something I could really benefit from. Other than that, I'm perfect.
Of course. That's what it said in your bio too. And last but not least, who are your heroes in life, Mike?
I thought about this full disclosure, I had the questions before this, but I thought a lot about this one. And it's going to sound so cliche, but it's so top of mind right now. My mom. I love her to death. She's the mother of six kids. She grew up in the Depression, and the woman is absolutely awesome. And I want to be a little bit more like her. I think that would be a really good thing.
That is not cliche at all. In fact, that would be one of my heroes, or probably my hero as well. I always like to say, if it can be a third of what my mom was, I'd be doing a pretty good job. Mike, it's been a delight and a pleasure to have this conversation with you. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise and a little bit about yourself.
I love it. I think that with the council's mandate and what we're trying to do is so, so important. And I love being part of it. So thank you for letting me. This is all.
Thank you for joining us on the Wellbeing Ignites Well Doing podcast, brought to you by OOT Social Health. We hope today's conversation has sparked new insights and inspired you to prioritize well-being in your journey to organizational success. Remember, when well-being ignites, well-doing follows. Stay tuned for more episodes as we continue to explore the power of human-centric leadership. Until then, be well and lead with purpose.